We are joined live in the studios, excuse me, once again by Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. We'll get this worked out. We have to think through saying afternoon and trip
instead
on each
of morning.
Other.
Yeah.
All right. So, Joff, you have you're still covered in parade
pig's blood.
Yes. Just having come from the Women's March.
Yes. Lots of folks showing up this morning for the Women's March 3.0. There's actually another Women's March tomorrow because there's a split among the organizers locally, which is unfortunate. The march this morning was probably about 10,000, I would guess. It's smaller than the last couple of years, but still a robust turnout. Lots of really creative signs, many of which I can't mention on the air because it's radio. Great turnout. There's still people at Seattle Center as we speak, and there will be another march tomorrow morning at Westlake at 10 a.m. And then, of course, the MLK march on Monday, so it's going to be a very busy weekend.
I think that one starts, the one tomorrow starts at Occidental Square.
Oh, and it goes to?
And it goes to Westlake.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, and it starts at Occidental Square at 10 a.m.
Yes.
So
okay.
If folks want to join that march. And then, of course, the Garfield one on Monday.
Yeah, Garfield High School, so that's 23rd and Jefferson.
Yeah, that march starts at 12:30, but there's lots of good things going on at Garfield High School
starting
at 8:30.
Yeah, the workshops start at 9 o'clock, I believe. And then workshops through the morning, and then the 11:30 rally, and 12:30, they set off for downtown.
Yeah.
All right. And we'll probably cover that again at the end of the hour.
Yes, we will.
Just to further confuse people. All right. So diving into this week's news and developments regarding the recent Seattle Police Department contract.
Yeah. The arbitration ruling, according to emails released to the Seattle Times under a Freedom of Information Act request, lawyers with the Seattle Police Officers Guild conspired with city attorneys to delay the arbitration agreement over Officer Adley Shepard's case until after the city council voted to approve the Seattle Police Officers Guild labor contract in November. Shepard was the cop who punched a handcuffed woman in the back of his patrol car in 2014. In 2016, he was fired by then Police Chief Kathleen O'Toole. Shepard then enlisted his union, the Seattle Police Officers Guild, to help him with his reinstatement with back pay through an arbitration process. That arbitration agreement was finished and ready to be announced last October 31st. But according to Officer Shepard, the Seattle Police Officers Guild and the police department sat on the ruling, and the city attorney's office sat on the ruling for more than 3 weeks for political reasons. They didn't want the arbitration ruling to influence the city council in their vote on the contract. That contract had already drawn fierce criticism from the Community Police Commission and 24 different community groups who had all urged the city council to reject the contract because it rolls back a number of police reforms, especially the process through which the Seattle Police Department disciplines officers who use excessive force.
And specifically, that process was used to reinstate Shepard.
Yeah, and the emails support Shepard's contention. They show Hillary McClure, a lawyer for the Seattle Police Officers Guild, Jane Wilkinson, the arbitrator, Assistant City Attorney Amy Lowen, Assistant Police Chief Leslie Cordner, and Officer Suzanne Parton, who was a Seattle Police Officers Guild representative, all working together to delay the release of Adley Shepard's arbitration agreement and their discussions over it. At one point, the SPOG representative, Officer Parton, wrote, quote, this interference in the arbitration process is unacceptable and possibly unethical. This process is supposed to be impartial and objective. And she goes on to write, I simply do not see how delaying the process for some political purpose is appropriate. Wilkinson, the arbitrator, wrote in reply, quote, I'm not thrilled about the delay either. However, I feel bound to the party's stipulations, end quote. In this case, of course, we have to assume that the parties who asked for and then agreed to the delay would be both the Seattle Police Officers Guild lawyers and the city attorney's counsel.
And let's review why they would want to delay it.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of SPOG, of course, they wanted the new contract to go through, as did Mayor Durkan. And there had been a lot of criticism over officers being able to sharp for arbitration under the old old system, and that system was reinstated in this contract that was negotiated by Mayor Durkin's team for the city.
The city council had passed legislation in 2017 that would have revised the disciplinary process and done away with the police officer's ability to shop around who they wanted to hear their appeals.
Yes, and Judge Robard, who's overseeing the reform process for the federal courts, had already criticized that particular provision of the contract. They were concerned that the city council might get cold feet, which is probably an unwarranted concern, because they tend to be kind of deferential to authority. And so the city council went ahead and approved it by a vote of 8-1. Shama Sawant was the only objection to that ratification.
The clearest reasoning we had as to why that many city council members supported the contract was that they decided to throw it over into the lap of Judge James Robart, the U.S. District Court judge who has been overseeing the reform process. As Job said, that yes, Robart has been concerned about this process of negotiating a new contract with the Seattle Police Officers Guild. Their contract expired, I believe it was back in 2014. They've been 4 years without a new contract for the city. And with every new police reform that the city has tried to institute, the Seattle Police Officers Guild representatives come back and say, oh, no, you can't do that. It's a violation. It's a labor violation. You know, you have to negotiate that with us in our upcoming contract, which they'd been delaying the negotiations for. Robart, last January, had announced that the city was now in compliance with the police reform process, which meant that the city has entered into a 2-year trial period in which they are meant to show that these police reforms that they passed in 2017, the reform law, would take effect and be a lasting change. But Robart had said way back in January 2018 when he made this announcement, he said, you know, there are some things that are still of concern. And one of those is this new contract with the Seattle Police Officers Guild that still has not been negotiated and signed at that point. So now he's got to take a good, clear look at this. And if he decides that that the SPOG contract doesn't comply with the city council's police reform law that it passed in 2017, and that it doesn't comply with the memorandum of agreement that the city entered into with the Department of Justice for police reform, then that would set us back to the beginning of another 2-year period in which the city would have to prove that it's complying with the new reform laws.
And that's under the contract that rolled back those city council reforms.
Yeah.
Which would now not be in effect. They would still need a new contract.
Yeah, they would still need to negotiate a new contract if Robart doesn't approve of it.
All right. Moving on. Mayor Durkin giving the go-ahead on the streetcar.
Yeah, this week Mayor Durkin announced that she does want to build the City Center Connector streetcar to link up the First Hill streetcar line to the South Lake Union trolley line via First Avenue downtown. But the costs are still spiraling out of control. Originally estimated costs were $143 million to build the City Connector line. The estimate was revised in 2017 to be about $200 million. In August of 2018, just last year, the estimate grew to $252 million. Now the Seattle Department of Transportation is calculating that it will cost at least $286 million.
We'll be at $500 before it's
over.
Yeah,
so approximately double of the original cost. The line, which was projected to open in 2020, will take until 2025 to complete. New costs in the current estimate include $17 million to change existing rails on the South Lake Union and First Hill lines to accommodate the bigger, heavier trains that SDOT purchased last year, plus expansion of the maintenance sheds to fit the larger trains. In addition, operating costs are going up. SDOT originally estimated about $16 million per year to operate the City Connector line. But King County Metro, who is under contract to operate the current streetcar lines for the city, said it would take about $24 million per year. And the latest estimate now puts the cost at $28 million per year starting in 2025.
Meanwhile, this being announced the week after the viaduct was closed down really reinforces the insane amount of congestion that the city is intentionally creating toward the waterfront, because, of course, with the viaduct gone and few people using the new tunnel, which will open next month and which does not have any access to downtown, that will dump a lot of the existing traffic onto First Avenue, which is exactly where the connector line will go. It will go from Pioneer Square up First Avenue to Stewart Street, and then from Stewart Street down to Westlake to to connect with the South Lake Union trolley. Meanwhile, you've got all the buses going onto the surface with the closure of the bus tunnel to accommodate the convention center expansion. It's going to be several years of extreme congestion, and particularly for that First Avenue corridor, which is where a lot of the existing housing for seniors and disabled people in the city of Seattle, public housing for those communities exists. A lot of people with health problems, breathing problems, the extreme congestion and the construction vibration and noise and dust, all the rest of it is going to pose health problems to those folks. There's a lot of opposition among community groups in that corridor to the streetcar, but Mayor Durkan decided that tourists were more important, which is pretty much par for the course for the city in that neighborhood.
Oh, yeah. It will definitely make tourists happy. And, of course, developers will love it because they'll see it as an enhancement to their property values, especially along that corridor, but throughout downtown altogether.
Which are already going up with the waterfront development.
Yeah. Both the South Lake Union and First Hill lines were a lot cheaper to build, and they're much cheaper to run, but they have very few riders. And it's not really clear that spending nearly $300 million to link them up with a First Avenue streetcar is going to add enough riders to make it a cost-effective transit solution for people living and working downtown and trying to get to their jobs, get home, et cetera.
The advantage of fixed rail is that it increases property values. Mm-hmm. It's not a transportation solution. It's a real estate solution.
Yeah.
And it really is a real estate boondoggle.
Yeah, and it has no flexibility built into it. As we can see from the fact that SDOT bought those bigger, heavier trains to accommodate a longer line that would run from Capitol Hill all the way to South Lake Union, and now they have to make all these expensive changes to those other two lines in South Lake Union and on First Hill, Capitol Hill. Now, it's interesting to watch Mayor Jenny Durkan badmouth former Mayor Ed Murray and his transportation director, Scott Kubley, for lowballing the costs to build this line. It's worth noting that she's making exactly the same bad decisions as her predecessor, choosing to continue this expensive vanity project instead of spending scarce transportation dollars in the city on projects that really need the work. And I can think of a couple right off my head. One of them is the Magnolia Bridge, which
was damaged in 2001 and has not been repaired.
Yeah, and is in such bad shape that that engineers estimate that even in a minor trembler, it could come crashing down. That's something that you think would take precedence over spending $300 million on a vanity project downtown. There are miles of sidewalk in the city that have never been built that need to be built, many more miles that need to be upgraded and fixed. And, of course, there's a question of what about linking up the bicycle lanes downtown, which nobody wants to spend a few million dollars to do, a much, much cheaper solution than spending $300 million for a streetcar line.
That very few people are going to use.
And,
well, you know,
a lot of people say that they would use it if the bicycle lanes actually
I'm talking about the streetcar.
Oh, the streetcar, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as with the SPOG contract, it really underscores Mayor Durkan's decision-making process, which very much does not include the public.
Yeah.
She really has shown a tendency to make major decisions behind closed doors with parties with a financial interest in the outcome of the decision.
Yeah, in this case, it's downtown businesses who really, really want the streetcar line and developers who want it to increase their property values.
Well, perhaps they will be major funders when she goes up for re-election.
Oh, they will.
Chances are good.
Yeah.
The eight ball says.
All right. Well, speaking of potential funders, Microsoft did a big PR number this week.
Do we have that laugh track queued up yet?
We are skipping that.
Yeah, okay. This week Microsoft announced it was making a $500 million pledge to tackle the housing crisis in Seattle and the East Side, as the Seattle Times gushed. But when you look at the details, that's not really what they're doing. They're going to take $475 million of cash that's just sitting in their bank accounts, and trust me, they have a lot of cash sitting in their bank accounts, and they will loan it out to developers to build what's called workforce housing, which is generally defined as housing for people who make 80% of median income. So here come
That's
the numbers.
That's not homelessness.
Yeah. So here come the numbers, folks. In 2017, the median income for a Seattle family was $100,630. 80% of that is $80,500. Minimum wage in Seattle is $16 per hour, or $33,280 per year.
It's 15.
Large businesses, it's going to be 16 this coming year.
Okay.
That's 33% of the median in a family with a single earner. With two minimum wage earners in a family, that household is still only at 66% of median income, nowhere near 80%. Bellevue's minimum wage is the state minimum wage of $12 per hour, or $24,960 per year for a single earner family. That's just under $50,000 for a family with two minimum wage earners. The median household income in Bellevue is pretty close to Seattle's. It's $100,703. They're really comparable, which puts a two earner minimum wage family at just under 50% of median income if they live in Bellevue. In Kirkland, which is Microsoft's backyard, median income is not much lower. It's $95,939. So a two-earner minimum wage family is still only at 52% of median income. They would not be able to afford workforce housing. And loans, I should point out, these loans that Microsoft is making are not donations. Microsoft is not giving that money away. It will be paid back to them in full, plus interest. Even if that interest is a little lower than a commercial loan would be, they're still making money off of this proposition. It is not a donation. Now, that leaves the other $25 million, which they are giving away, and it's about 5% of the total that they announced that they are, quote unquote, pledging is the actual donation. 80% of this will go to existing services for low-income people who are at risk of becoming homeless. 20% of it, or $5 million, will go to help fund the new regional consolidation of homelessness services in the King County, General King County area. The Microsoft pledge is the first major project to come out of the work by an organization called Challenge Seattle, which is an interesting group. It's composed of CEOs of 18 major corporations in the greater Seattle area, including Jeff Bezos of Amazon, Brad Smith and Satya Nadella of Microsoft, Kevin Johnson of Starbucks, Kevin McAllister of Boeing, and Devin Stockfish of Weyerhaeuser, among many others in this group. The concept of large corporations using their wealth to fund public works sounds like a good idea until you really start looking at the details. In this deal, Microsoft has found a way to make money out of loaning a tiny amount of their $126 billion in cash reserves while earning lots of positive publicity for their so-called generosity. And their $25 million donation is less than 0.02% of their total cash reserves. That's kind of like me taking out a $5 bill out of my pocket and saying, look, everybody, look, I'm making a massive donation to affordable housing. That's really literally
and,
what
and
it is.
And giving it to somebody on the street.
Yeah. And
randomly.
And for somebody who makes minimum wage, it would be like taking a penny or a nickel and saying, look at this ginormous donation I'm making. That's the amount of impact this donation will have on Microsoft's cash reserves, not even their bottom line. So that's something that people should consider. No other members of the Challenge Seattle group has offered to donate any cash, just Microsoft, for affordable housing. While Amazon in particular, but other members of the group as well, worked to defeat the Seattle City Council's effort to tax them to build affordable housing. So that's also worth remembering too. And the effort that they're supporting, the move to regional homelessness response to consolidate homelessness services and on a regional level, has at its heart, if you look at the recommendations made by a recent study, that was commissioned by Dow Constantine and Mayor Jenny Durkin. It has at its very heart the establishment of a public-private partnership to fund the building of more workforce housing. So whether or not it's going to be a solution to affordable housing, we'll have to see. But my guess is it's not going to be any more of a solution than this Microsoft quote-unquote pledge.
And it kind of reeks of company towns.
It really does. It really does.
Which never really works out very well for workers.
Yeah, and it really shows you what we got when Jenny Durkin was elected and why people should have gone to the ballot for Carrie Moon. Because Jenny Durkin is really proving herself to be sort of a mainstream corporate Republican mayor.
Yeah, bought and owned.
Yes.
Wouldn't you assume that the loans, they would get to choose who the loans go to?
Oh, yes. I mean, they're setting up their own fund to do it. It's not as if they're just giving it over to the city saying, here, you manage it.
Right.
Yeah.
And I also saw online this morning that in 2017 that Microsoft benefited from about just over $150 million in tax benefits from the state of Washington.
Oh, yes. So, Microsoft is still treated as if it's a tech startup when it's a legacy company now. And that's one of the issues I think that the state legislature should be tackling in this session that's going on right now, is closing the tax loopholes for some of those companies that have been getting a free ride, big companies like Microsoft and Boeing, for example, both legacy companies, both well able to stand on their own, and they do not need the tax breaks
anymore. Amazon's in there.
And Amazon's another company that you could argue is also a legacy company at this point.
Yep.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
Let's move along.
All right. News out this week about Washington's greenhouse gases.
Yeah, the Washington Department of Ecology released a report this week. Washington state law has a requirement that was passed several years ago by the legislature that Washington work toward 1990 greenhouse gas emissions levels by the year 2020, which, surprise, is next year. And Washington state, by all appearances, is not going to make that target. The report from the DOE says that between 2012 and 2015, that is up until about 3 years ago, for that four-year period, greenhouse gas emissions rose 6.1% from the previous levels. Now, that is not the direction, obviously, that it needs to be going in, and that greenhouse gas emissions level has been rising steadily since the legislature passed that law in 2010, underscoring that the failure of the legislature to act, for example, on Governor Inslee's many climate change proposals has come at a cost, and that cost is that the state is not going to meet its targets. The State Department of Ecology report says that the state has taken some effective steps to limit greenhouse gas emissions, and the primary factor in the rise has been the booming economy and the growth in population, which was not necessarily anticipated when that target was set. But it really begs the question, with the legislature now in session, of what the legislature is going to do. Clearly, they're going to miss that 2020 target, but clearly also some fairly radical out-of-the-box solutions are needed to get things moving in the right direction. And we're not hearing those proposals from Democrats in the legislature, let alone Republicans. So it's hard to see where the solution is going to come from.
Yeah, the main environmental issue that the Democrats have been talking about is banning plastics in the city, in the state, banning plastic bags, plastic straws, plastic utensils, et cetera, in order to help the orcas in Puget Sound and to prevent water pollution. They're not really talking that much about the air, about the atmosphere, about global warming and our state's carbon emissions.
Which is a major factor also in threatening the orcas.
Yes, because of increasing water temperatures. Increasing water temperatures makes it much harder for salmon and other cold water fish to spawn in our rivers. It also brings drought conditions in eastern Washington and other parts of the region, which means lower water flows. All of that impacts the salmon population. And our southern resident orca population, that's their diet, is salmon. Yeah.
And the increasing acidity of the oceans is not helping.
Not helping either. And that's a function of global warming.
All right. Anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
Let's move on then to national, starting with New revelations this week regarding the Trump administration and migrant children.
Yeah, the Inspector General for the Department of Health and Human Services released a report this week admitting that the Trump administration had begun separating parents and their children at the border and ports of entry starting at least a year before May 2018, not long, that is, after Trump was sworn into office. So many children have been stolen from their families and then lost in the system that Health and Human Services says that the total number is now unknown. Last May, a lawsuit against the Trump administration forced the government to identify 2,700 children that they had separated from their family. That number eventually increased to over 3,000. Some of the kids were infants and toddlers too young to speak. Thousands of more children were removed from their parents and either eventually released or sent to foster care. That appears to be the case now, according to this report. The inspector general said that the only way that HHS tracked these children was with a spreadsheet kept by the refugee office, which was then eventually posted online for other agencies to contribute to if they wanted to. In fact, many didn't.
And so basically, the administration kidnapped these kids.
Essentially, yeah. And HHS still does not have a reliable system for tracking children who have been separated from their parents. That's the real shocker here, is that they've not learned the lesson and made any changes. Also, the Trump administration is still separating children from parents, in case you didn't know that.
Yeah, and all of this is in violation of existing court orders at this point.
Yeah, and they say that they do it if the parents have a criminal history. But let's make clear that a criminal history in this case can mean anything from a traffic infraction to an immigration violation. And those offenses may have been committed many, many years in the past. In other words, the Trump administration is removing children from immigrants in situations where they would never take a child from a U.S. citizen who has, say, a prior record of speeding tickets when they were a teenager or something of that nature. And while the federal government is closing the concentration camp for migrant teenagers in Tornillo, Texas, they've decided to expand a similar facility in Homestead, Florida, another quote-unquote temporary shelter that is holding teenagers in prison-like conditions. The Florida shelter features military barracks, wire fences, and guards. The Miami-Dade County Public School District is very concerned about this so-called shelter because the Trump administration has not asked them to provide any teachers for the 1,350 kids who are currently housed there. And the Trump administration wants to expand it to double the capacity of that shelter.
Yeah, which is about the size of what the Tornillo has been.
Yeah, about the size of the Tornillo shelter. Currently, there are a total of about 10,500 migrant teenagers, as much as we know, there may be more, being held in about 100 detention sites around the U.S. Some of them have been in detention for many months in violation of the Flores Agreement, which said that the federal government cannot hold migrant families in detention for longer than a few days before they have to find them suitable places to live or else release them.
And the best estimate that I've seen in terms of the number of kids who've been separated from their parents, and it is just a guess because nobody has the actual number.
Which is why they're round numbers.
Yes, is up to about 15,000, which is just staggering. Yeah. We've got, as we speak, President Trump is proposing a solution which is already being rejected. I'm looking at my phone while we talk, by Nancy Pelosi, trying to call the situation on the southern border a humanitarian crisis. It is a humanitarian crisis, but it is the Trump administration that is causing it.
That has caused that crisis. Yes.
All right. Well, for those of you just tuning in, we're talking with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchuk, local writers and activists, giving us an update of the news from this past week. We're, of course, doing this show now in an hour-long format here live from KODX. So
yeah, and if you like what you hear on KODX and you want to contribute, we're an all-volunteer station. We're a nonprofit. You can go online to kodxseattle.org and hit our Patreon button there and set yourself up to make regular contributions to support the station and to support the content.
And while you're on the website, check out the schedule because KODX is airing a lot of amazing programs, including a number of the programs that were on Mind Over Matters before we migrated.
That's right. We moved.
Saturday has been completely redone here at the station, and we could use your support in financial support so that we can expand our hours. We're only doing basically daylight hours currently, and the days are going to be getting longer here soon, and so we would like
we
to.
We hope, anyway.
Yes, unless this world completely tilts off its axis and spins into the sun.
We could use some volunteers.
In which case, we'll still need your donations.
That's yeah. right. Just as much to let you know what's going on. All right. So moving on to numerous other incidents and developments this week in Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Today is exactly the second anniversary of Trump's inauguration. And we celebrated it all week with a jubilee of scandals involving the Trump administration and a lot of revelations of the ongoing investigations in those scandals. It started last weekend with, of course, the New York Times reporting on Friday night and then the Washington Post reporting on Saturday. And the New York Times story revealing that the FBI had opened a counterintelligence investigation into whether Donald Trump was a witting or unwitting Russian asset as early as May of 2017. And the following day, the Washington Post reporting that Trump has been going to extraordinary lengths to cover up the content of his conversations with Vladimir Putin, up to and including seizing the notes from the interpreters, which those interpreters are apparently going to be compelled to testify before the Democratic House soon. Yeah. There's a lot of movement toward that.
And there wasn't just one meeting. A lot of people remember the one meeting with Vladimir Putin, but there have been at least five.
There have been five. The seizure of notes was first happened, I believe, in the Hamburg G20 meeting in 2017.
Each time he has locked his aides out of a lot of these meetings, he has taken the notes of his interpreters, and he has done his best to keep the contents of his conversations secret.
And those two revelations in conjunction with each other really underscore the question, okay, if you had a president of the United States who was a Russian agent, how would that president be doing anything differently from what Donald Trump has been doing? There really is no difference because he has taken at every step what looks like actions that are meant to benefit the Russian Federation more than the United States. It's very troubling. And so you're getting within Congress talk of we can't wait for Robert Mueller to Mueller to release his report before we start investigating and potentially impeaching this person because it's become an urgent national security matter, which honestly, the day he was inaugurated 2 days ago, he became the biggest national security threat to the United States. And that was, I think, obvious to a lot of us at the time.
I mean, two days after.
Yeah. Yeah. With Michael Flynn as his national security advisor while he was on the payroll of foreign governments. So, you know, we had that. Then we had the drama this week in the Senate with the Senate and House trying to roll back the Trump administration's decision to lift sanctions on companies that had been majority owned by Russian oligarch Oleg Deripaska, who, as you'll recall, was Paul Manafort's former boss and was also instrumental in the interference in the 2016 elections by Russia. So that narrowly failed in the Senate. It had 58 votes, including 11 Republicans, but it required 60 to get past a filibuster on the full floor. Meanwhile, the House vote, which didn't get as much attention, there were 300-some people who voted in favor of it, including about 160 different Republicans that split with the Trump administration's trying to restore these sanctions on Deripaska's companies. So you're seeing some movement by Republicans, which some of us thought might never come, away from the Trump administration on the question of sanctions in particular in this case, and accommodating the Trump administration's obsequiousness toward Russia more generally.
And it seems to be starting in the House, where Republican representatives are more sensitive to the voters' change in whether or not they support the president and voters' attitudes towards what's going on in the White House.
Yeah. And so you had that happen. And then later in the week, former attorney and fixer and all-around mob figure Michael Cohen claimed that he paid for fake polling on Trump's order in 2015 to influence online polling to make Trump seem like a more credible challenger in a potential 20, 2016 primary run, you'll bear in mind that that's approximately the same time in the presidential election cycle as we're coming up on now for 2020. So we had that, and then BuzzFeed's report on Thursday that Cohen lied to Congress about the extent of Trump Tower Moscow negotiations at the direct direction of Donald Trump. That would be a serious felony, suborning perjury, and again reignited talk of impeachment in the House.
Yeah, what's interesting about that story? I read that story too, and I, you know, when you look at a story from a source like BuzzFeed, you think, and a lot of you see this a lot in the mainstream media. Oh, if it's of them saying, oh, if it's true. But then I looked at the two authors of the story are both seasoned journalists who have won Pulitzer Prizes. They're not just gossip columnists.
Yeah.
It's a story that has a lot of credibility. And they say that they spoke with a couple of law enforcement people who've been working on the case. And they say that not just Donald Trump, but also Trump's children, Ivanka and Donald Jr., were still pursuing the Moscow, the Trump Tower Moscow project well into his campaign, and even perhaps up to when he was in office, that they were both very instrumental, that they talked with Michael Cohen regularly about it in great detail, and that Cohen was urged by them to meet with Russian counterparts in order to get the deal closed.
Yeah, and that there was a lot of negotiations to get Trump and Putin to meet during the campaign.
Yeah, yeah, and that Donald Trump had agreed on that at one point.
I would caution on the authors, the lead author, Jason Leopold, I think a lot of reason for the caution, and of course we had the extraordinary statement from the special counsel last night saying that some aspect of the story he claimed was not accurate. And BuzzFeed's response was, we stand by our story. We've spoken to our sources post-publication, and they stand by it. And we would like clarification from the special counsel's office
as to what isn't true.
What they're disputing. Leopold, however, got in a lot of trouble, I think circa 2007, for reporting that a grand jury in Washington, D.C. was going to indict Karl Rove in the Valerie Plame affair. That turned out not to be true, and he got a lot of heat for that not coming to fruition. And I think people with long memories in D.C. are remembering and being cautious about his scoops, although he has been really at the forefront of breaking a number of the Trump Tower Moscow stories over the past several months.
Mm-hmm, that have turned out to be true.
Yes.
All right. Anything else on that?
No. Next week will be interesting, too.
I have no doubt. All right. So moving on and sticking with the Trump administration for 200 points. a couple of court decisions this week.
Yeah, a couple of court decisions. Judge Haywood Gilliam, Jr. of the U.S. District Court in Oakland, California, blocked the Trump administration's new rule that would allow employers to weasel out of providing contraceptive coverage to their female employees based on their not just religious objections, but moral objections to providing contraceptive coverage. Like with the administration's immigration rules, there's a little bit of a history here. The Trump administration released a first set of rules that was blocked in court back in 2017. And then they issued a revised second set of rules. This is the set of rules that Judge Gilliam was looking at. But Judge Gilliam said that he could see no difference between the first set and the second set, that they're, in his mind, approximately the same. He allowed the 13 states that sued the Trump administration to halt the rules from taking effect in their states until the lawsuit is decided in court. That was his ruling to block it. Those 13 states where the rules will not take effect are California, Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Illinois, Maryland, Minnesota, New York, North Carolina, Rhode Island, Vermont, Virginia, Washington State, and the District of Columbia. The rules will take effect in all the other states in the United States, meaning that women will no longer be able to have no-cost contraceptive care from their doctors. They will not be able to get free pills. They will not be able to do no-cost family planning anymore because of the Trump administration. This is one of the main reasons that you saw women in the street today, at the Women's March.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And to underscore, I think there will be additional legal challenges to this.
Oh, there will. But, there is still the current lawsuit going through.
But and you would think that just based discrimination on the basis of gender, that that this would be legally vulnerable. It boggles my mind that this is going into effect in much of the country at this point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, credit to Attorney General Bob Ferguson in Washington State for joining this lawsuit and winning that exemption for Washington women.
Mm-hmm. Meaning that Washington women or women in California or any of those 13 states that I mentioned will still be able to get their no-cost coverage for their contraceptive services. But everywhere else, women will have to start paying again. And that means a lot of impoverished women will be having to deal with unplanned pregnancies. And that, I think, is just you want to talk about humanitarian crisis. Yeah. That, I think, is completely inhuman.
And I think, you know, what we're going to see in 2019, we're going to start to see rulings at the Supreme Court level with Trump's two new Supreme Court appointees. You now have a majority of Catholic justices on the Supreme Court who object not just to Roe v. Wade, but to contraception rights. That's going to be a very, very serious issue and intensely controversial. I'm braced for that happening. We don't know what case that's going to be attached to, but surely the Supreme Court is going to try and find a case they can rule on that with.
Yeah. Now, the second case in which the Trump administration lost was Judge Jess Furman of the U.S. District Court in Manhattan blocking the Commerce Department from adding a question about citizenship to the 2020 U.S. Census. He ruled that Wilbur Ross, who is the head of the Commerce Department, had arbitrarily decided to add the question against the recommendation of both the Justice Department, which reviews the legality of rules issued by the Trump administration, and the Census Bureau, who had warned him not to do it. Now, as in other arbitrary decisions made by Trump administration officials, Ross provided no credible reason for why the question must be included in the 2020 census. Judge Furman said that Ross broke a number of federal rules by doing that, that he ignored or twisted evidence that didn't support his view, that he and his aides gave false or misleading statements under oath while trying to explain his reasoning to Judge Furman, which you just don't do. I mean, have we not heard of perjury here?
Yeah, that should open them up to criminal charges, honestly.
Yeah. Now, the evidence presented in court overwhelmingly concluded that adding a citizenship question would deter both immigrants and Hispanic citizens from completing the census form. Wilbur Ross's decision to include the question, therefore, violated rulings by the Supreme Court in the past that the census must include non-citizens as well as citizens. Everyone who lives within the United States must be counted. That's been the Supreme Court's stance all along.
And the motivation for this is very clear. It's not just racism, although I'm sure that played a part too, but it's Republicans wanting to minimize the census count in urban areas that would support Democrats.
Yeah, it's a fundamental representation matter. The 2020 census provides a count of citizens in each state, and that count determines the number of representatives that state will have to the U.S. House for each state, and it determines how the districts will be redrawn in 2021. It's a fairness issue. It's a matter of how many representatives you have to represent the number of people in your state. So everyone must be counted. The Republicans are trying to get around that by not counting everyone, and that is fundamentally illegal and fundamentally unconstitutional. Judge Furman ruled not necessarily on that aspect of it, but he ruled on, primarily on the fact that Ross violated the rules for making changes at the federal level. When you order something like that, you have to have a good reason. And Ross had no reason that was rational or reasonable or cited any evidence provided by the Department of Justice or by the Census Bureau or by anyone.
And at this point, with the census coming up in a little over a year, those census forms need to be printed and all the other logistical things that need to happen.
So this has to be decided soon.
This has to be decided soon, and there's a limited amount of time to appeal or to reverse this ruling, or for the administration to redraw the rule in a way that is compliant with federal regulations, still discriminatory since that part of it wasn't ruled on in this ruling. The first impulse of the Trump administration would be to try and do it in a way that would satisfy the judge, yeah. but still keep people out of the count, but they're not going to have the time to do that. So, you know, when they try and appeal this particular ruling, this is going to be it. This is going to be what will determine what goes on the 2020 census.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Then that moves us on to international news and a study out this week regarding ICE.
We're starting to get a little bit inured to new studies on global warming and saying, you know, things are bad.
But they are.
They are. And this one struck me as particularly bad. It was a new study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences looking at measurements of ice loss in Antarctica from 1979 to 2018. What it found was that the continent lost 40 billion tons of melting ice every year from 1979 to 1989. Now, that's bad enough, but it rose to 252 billion tons per year beginning in 2009, which was when we would have been, the United States and other countries would have been coming out of the last recession that was caused by the housing crisis. That's a sixfold increase over the rate from 1979 to 1989.
And it comes after 8 years of inaction on climate change from the Bush administration.
Mm-hmm. And while much of the attention has been on the loss of ice in West Antarctica, about 219 billion tons per year, that's about how much is lost in West Antarctica, this study also looked at East Antarctica for the first time and found significant ice loss there too. Now, if you look at a map of Antarctica, you see that West Antarctica sits closer, it's lower in elevation, sits closer to the water, and sure, you would expect a lot more ice to be lost in that area. It's also a lot closer to places where people from the United States and Europe can visit Antarctica, and a lot of research stations sit in West Antarctica.
Yeah. East Antarctica, immediately south of South America.
Yeah, East Antarctica is higher in elevation. It has fewer bays that make it much harder to access, and there are far fewer research stations there. So it's been much harder for them to get any data. And the assumption has been for a long time, because it's higher in elevation and sheltered a bit from the water, that there hasn't been as much ice loss there. But this study for the first time found significant ice loss in East Antarctica. While the West Antarctic ice sheet contains enough water to raise sea levels by about 17 feet, East Antarctica contains enough to raise sea levels by 170 feet, a tenfold increase above what climate researchers have been saying they expect to be rising sea levels by 2100. Increasing ice loss there could mean massive coastal flooding decades earlier than previously predicted.
Yeah, we're affecting hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people.
Yeah. So, you know, this was the week, too, when Andrew Wheeler, the coal industry executive that Donald Trump appointed as EPA administrator, had his confirmation hearings before Congress. And he was asked, Bernie Sanders, I think, asked him, do you believe global warming is the greatest crisis facing our planet? And his response was, oh, no, not the greatest crisis. No, sir.
No, jobs in West Virginia are the greatest crisis facing the planet.
Yeah. But I would say that the scientific community absolutely disagrees and profoundly disagrees with that assertion. And studies like this one are really proving that Andrew Wheeler and Donald Trump are wrong.
Yeah, and I think a vast majority of people under the age of 30 would agree with that also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
that's terrifying.
Yeah, leaves you speechless, doesn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a lot of terrifying things happening.
Mm-hmm. It is
both
true.
In this country and around us as we speak. And we still got 10 minutes left. And kind of.
So let me talk a little bit about what Trump just went on TV and offered as we were talking here.
Okay.
He presented his speech as, this will break the deadlock and lead to a reasonable compromise between the two sides. And basically what he's offering is a deal on DACA and the immigrants who I'm reading off my phone as I do this. What was it? It's called the Bridge Act, and it would be a temporary deal for DACA and for folks who are, it's a 10 to 14 year path to citizenship for 1.8 million Dreamers, as well as permanent status and full protections afforded to all U.S. citizens, which of course, because it would be citizenship. That's basically the same deal that was announced about a year ago that Trump decided to reject, even though it had sufficient votes in both the Democrats, both the Senate and the House under Republican leadership. And the Democrats at that point had offered $25 million for a border wall in exchange for that, but Trump decided to reject it. Now he's trying to get $5 billion for the wall, which is, of course, a much smaller number.
By proposing the same deal that the Democrats had announced earlier, right?
Yes, and Pelosi has already come out and said this is a non-starter. Let's restart the government first, and then we can talk about the compromise. You know, we're not going to negotiate with a hostage taker, basically, which, you know, is
sort
sound
of standard policy.
Procedure. Yeah. So you have that. Meanwhile, you know, he's what was I going to say here? It looks like it's going to be a non-starter, and the shutdown is going to continue going, which is nearly a month now. It's, I believe, in day 29. And starting to seriously hurt a number of not just government employees, but people who rely on government employees, you know, small businesses, et cetera, for their income and patronage.
How much of this do you think is desperation on Trump's part, that he's starting to see that, you know, he's not going to win on the wall and he has to start making concessions?
I think all of it. He's really painted himself into a corner, and there's no obvious way out. And the Democrats, and you know, credit Nancy Pelosi on this. She has kept her party and Schumer in the Senate as well very united in rejecting the hostage taking. And you know, the poll after poll after poll shows that a wide majority of Americans are blaming Trump for this shutdown and this negotiation impasse, as they should.
Because he did take credit for it.
Yeah, he did. And he's throwing a tantrum, basically. Uh-huh. And, you know, it's hard to see what the path for breaking the impasse will be other than Trump just, deferring on the wall. Because it really is, from any kind of rational policy standpoint, a ridiculous proposal. You know, the vast majority of not just undocumented individuals, but drugs and all the other horrors that Trump is trying to scare his base with come through either people who are overstaying their visas and illegally, especially through airports, or going through standard ports of entry. And, you know, you have cartels moving contraband through standard ports of entry, through tunnels, which can go under walls as well. There's just all sorts of facts that underscore that this would not be an effective use of money.
Let's talk a little bit about Steve King, who was censored by
let's do that
by his own party and removed from several committees because he had made racist comments. In an interview with the New York Times, his most recent racist comment was that there was, what's the difference between white supremacy and, you know...
Yeah, when did that become a bad
Western,
thing to talk about?
And Western civilization.
Became a bad thing to talk about when you know, neo-Nazis started using it as a dog whistle.
Well, it became a bad thing to talk about, I don't know, a couple generations ago.
Yeah, exactly.
At least.
And meanwhile, so the Republicans try to... go ahead and censure King, which really should have happened at least a decade ago. Yeah. And, you know, you had a different representative, I believe, from Missouri, who yelled at a California Democrat, go back to Puerto Rico, as he was waiting to speak at his microphone. So the Republicans don't seem to have cleansed racism from their caucus.
Yeah, no,
for this
move. The focus seems to be immigrants and particularly Hispanic people. One of the notorious comments Steve King had made was that he thought Hispanic men in coming across the border had calves like cantaloupes because they carry 75 pounds of marijuana on their back when they're coming across the desert. And I remember hearing that and thinking, talk about somebody living in fantasy land. That is not how
drugs
come into the United States. They come in on the undersides of trucks through ports of entry. They don't come in on the backs of people swimming in the Rio Grande and hiking through the desert.
No, not at all.
So the racism, the deep vein of racism we see running through the Republican Party seems to be less focused on Black people these days than it is on Hispanic people and immigrants, people who don't speak with the right kind of accent. And I find that to be deeply disturbing.
Yeah, although to his credit, Trump is an equal opportunity racist. He's happy to insult Blacks and Muslims as well.
As Manigo Newman pointed out.
Yeah. So it was, I suppose the Republicans deserve a little bit of credit for censuring King, but they stripped him of committee assignments, which is good, but they also should have kicked him out of their caucus.
Yeah,
and they did not do that.
A couple of them said, why don't you resign? But, it is possible for the Republicans to sanction him so much that he can't do his job and is forced to resign. But yes, they have not done that yet.
And he is facing a primary challenger now, mm-hmm. that was announced this past week, who is every bit as crazy as the modern Republican Party allows, but he knows enough to keep his mouth shut about racial issues. And therefore is probably going to get a lot of the mainstream Republican support next time around.
Mm-hmm. Also this week we had William Barr, I believe, before the Senate.
Yes. And, his most of the coverage of his confirmation hearings had to do with the Mueller investigation and whether he would allow it to continue, which, of course, he said he would. And then it appeared that he said that he would not release the results of the Mueller investigation directly to the public, that he would go through and determine what it was possible to release to the public. And that brought up issues of censorship and so forth. And I thought that was kind of interesting.
But I think, to me, the more interesting part of his testimony, which, of course, the Senate was happy to confirm him with this, is that he thought Jeff Sessions did a really good job, and he backed up Sessions' priority on the war on drugs and a number of other extremely problematic aspects of
rollbacks on police reform.
Yeah,
for example, voting
rights. I think there's a lot of aspects to Barr's testimony that were deeply disturbing that didn't get a lot of
attention. Didn't get much coverage.
Not to mention his history of encouraging George Bush Sr. to pardon six of the Iran-Contra leaders.
He would have been instrumental in that decision because he was Attorney General under George H.W. Bush, the elder Bush.
So he would have been
in the room recommending to him whether or not he could do that.
Question.
And of course, I think there's plenty of people available. There will be available to pardon in the coming years as well.
Oh, yes. Yes, well, indeed.
Exactly.
For example, almost the entire Trump cabinet.
Yes.
So,
but I am looking forward to the first cabinet meeting at which Barr is required to, obsequiously praise the leader, the dear leader. that's going to be a little awkward.
As all of his cabinet members are required to do these days.
Yes.
All right. Events.
Yeah. As we mentioned at the top of the show, for people who tuned in nearly an hour ago now, yay. This is the weekend of marches. It's MLK weekend. We had a big march this morning that commemorated the year 3 of the Trump administration, Women's March from Capitol Hill to Seattle Center. Tomorrow, there will be another Women's March.
Not to commemorate year 3, but to protest year 3.
Yeah, well, that's a commemoration. it's a jubilee. Tomorrow morning, there will be another march, if he hasn't been impeached by then, which I expect he won't have been.
That will start
at 10 o'clock at Occidental Square.
Yeah, that's the Be the Change Network Women's March and Seattle Women's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women March together.
We are the Change is the title of it.
Yeah.
And that will start at Occidental Square at 10 o'clock and go... I believe to Westlake Park, mm-hmm. and then later on Sunday, a discussion and panel that's being hosted as part of today's march. They're doing workshops tomorrow, and a very good-looking one hosted by the Women's March and the Tenants Transit Riders Union. Homelessness: How Do We Move Forward? That's a workshop that will be held at the Finney Neighborhood Association, 6532 Finney Avenue North, the community center there. That will be tomorrow at 2 o'clock. And, of course, Monday is MLK Day and the annual workshops in March. Folks will gather at 8:30 at Garfield High School, 23rd and Jefferson in the CD. And there will be workshops throughout the morning, which, as usual, is an outstanding roster of workshops on different issues. And then a rally at 11:30 and a march downtown at 12:30. So that's your MLK day for you. And then the rest of the week, we will keep resisting and keep protesting.